Welcome, everyone, to episode 433 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Zaporik, and we would have previewed every round two matchup today, but the Los Angeles Clippers screwed up our plans. So we are going to preview Nets, Bucks, Sixers, Hawks, Suns, Nuggets, and then we will finish up with the preview of Clippers, Mavericks, Game 7. So sorry to the Utah Jazz, we cannot preview your matchup.
Did the Clippers screw up or did the Mavs screw up?
Well, we'll get into that for sure. Before we get underway, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. We're recording our show today on Locker Room, the only live audio social network for sports fans. Listen to our show on Locker Room before it hits your iTunes feed, engage with us in real time, or start your own room to react to the draft, trade news, and more. Take the mic and download Locker Room in the Apple App Store. Joining me today, as always, is a guy who must be delighted about the NBA schedule tomorrow, Morten Jensen. How's it going?
It's going well. I am very delighted about the schedule for tomorrow. I'm getting two games in Danish prime time. Can't complain. Right before we start, Brian, just if people out there are listening in and they're hearing some noise in my background, it's because I have to have the window open. It is becoming super hot. It's becoming proper summertime here in Copenhagen. So instead of me living in an oven, I decided to open the window, and my kitchen where I record, because that's how rich I am, is right outside the road. So if you hear a lot of traffic, apologies, but I just don't want to die.
That's fair, and it cannot be worse than the cicadas, who are still out and about in Baltimore. So lots of ambient noise throughout. If you have a baby that likes white noise, you're in luck. This podcast will be perfect for you. Mort, we have round two starting tonight with what is shaping up to probably be the series of the playoffs. Brooklyn Nets, Milwaukee Bucks. This is the series we were hoping that we would get to see. The Heat and the Celtics did not pull upsets in the first round. These two teams are entering mostly at full strength, but as we covered recently, Dante DiVincenzo is out for the playoffs, and Jeff Green, he's at least out for game one, that, as far as I know, with this foot injury. It sounds like, I saw in Zach Lowe's preview, they do expect him to return at some point in the series, but return is TBD. But otherwise, you know, we've got Brooklyn's big three is healthy, Milwaukee's big three is healthy. I think that's where we have to start on both sides. So, you know, as we were looking ahead back in, you know, April and May, and we saw that this series could be a real possibility, we were saying the Bucks defensively have the personnel to match up pretty well with the Nets. How do you see them matching up specifically with Brooklyn's big three?
Yeah, so I don't necessarily think it's going to be one of those one-to-one matchups. I think it's going to be team schemes from both teams, honestly. I think that's going to be more along the lines of how it works. But I do think overall the defensive capabilities of Milwaukee is far superior than that of the Brooklyn Nets. So from a defensive perspective, I'm just not that concerned about Milwaukee's lineup. I think that is so much better. What I'm nervous about if I'm Milwaukee is just the sheer offensive potency of the Brooklyn Nets, because even if you have a plus defender in Giannis, because obviously he's the defending defensive player of the year, even if you have a plus defender in Chris Middleton and a plus defender in Drew Holiday, you also have plus offensive players in Kyrie Irving, Kevin Durant, and James Harden. So it really comes down to, can you at least force those three, or two of three even, to get into one of those situations where they need to take a lot of shots to get just a decent amount of points. You know, one of those, if you are going to average 30, you want them to take 28 shots to get there.
Right.
The thing is, I don't know how that's gonna succeed. But before I continue, Brian, one thing I want to know, because I think we need to dedicate a lot of time to talk about this. I've seen this narrative also shaping up like Brooklyn is the offensive team and Milwaukee is the defensive team. Is it lost on people that the Bucks led the entire league in scoring during the regular season?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's ultimately, if you're leaning Bucks in this series, you're thinking that their offense is going to be able to keep up with Brooklyn's offense, and their defense is much better than Brooklyn's. Therefore, they should have the advantage. Because as you said, they, you know, they, yes, you're not going to stop Kevin Durant. Like, Kevin Durant's not going to score like 6 points a game in this series. You know, like, right. He's going to get his 25 to 30. But if you can goad him into being inefficient, I feel like, honestly, if you're going to goad anyone into being inefficient, it's Harden. I think
Harden. I was going to go Kyrie. Wow. Okay.
Oh no. Because I think wow. Drew is probably going to be on Kyrie as the right. main assignment, and I think Giannis is probably going to draw Durant at least at first, which means you're either going to do Middleton on Harden, or you know, in theory, this is where you're missing Dante DiVincenzo because you could just like yep. make him the sacrificial lamb. You know, he's six extra fouls at this point. I don't know that you can confidently put Pat Connaughton on Harden. Like, so maybe you do Middleton on him right away and then Connaughton on Joe Harris. But at the same time, like it's similar to, you know, what the Sixers did to Russell Westbrook. Like if you can leave him some airspace and invite him to take open jumpers, not that James Harden is nearly as bad of a jump shooter as Russell Westbrook, but if you can go James Harden into taking those step back threes, I'll just keep coming back to it. Like, on a team with Joe Harris, Kyrie Irving, Kevin Durant, Blake Griffin, some firepower off the bench as well, if you are goading James Harden into isolation step-back threes, that's a win. Even if he's going to hit some, that's not saying he's going to miss every single one, but that's just not good offense, and it's not going to lead to major defensive breakdowns. So that's the guy that I would be trying to invite into taking as many shots as possible. I think the Nets are at they're most terrifying when he is playmaker James Harden and then like secondary right. scorer and Durant and Irving are taking the primary scoring loads. If you can make him back into Houston Harden, we've seen how that goes in the playoffs.
That's a fair point. That's a fair point. I will say this though. That's the playmaking concerns. You actually touched on it. That's where my concern is because he's a smart player. We don't really yeah. give James Harden enough credit for just his basketball intelligence, in particularly on the offensive end of the court. I do feel that he is one of those players who have an easier time adjusting. If like people are overplaying him, he will get into a sort of a passing game mm-hmm. where Kyrie is maybe less inclined to do that because he really only has that one true elite skill, which is putting the ball in the basket. So if you can sort of goad him into being the shot taker, the guy who really has to get the offense going, I think there is a chance that you could get him out of the rhythm just a little bit. But at the same time, it's also Kyrie Irving. He can pull a shot out of his ass with half yeah. a second remaining because he's just that creative with the ball. But you're right. Like the isolation thing, I think that's going to be the theme going in here because like one thing is that these three guys with the Nets are all great isolation players. They have very, very large resumes of being isolation scorers in the over the course of their entire NBA career. Mm-hmm. But if you can get them into this your turn, my turn approach, that is going to help the Milwaukee Bucks, I think, because that is going to minimize ball movement. It's going to just make the offense a little bit more predictable.
Yeah.
But this is where the presence of Joe Harris can really put a wrench into the things for Milwaukee.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, the more isolations, like they have great individual defenders and they have a good team scheme as well. But the more you can coax defensive breakdowns out of Milwaukee, the better chance you have of generating efficient offense if you're Brooklyn. And I think Joe Harris is definitely a guy, like a key X factor to watch in this series. The other thing I'm watching defensively from Milwaukee, we know, you know, Brook Lopez and this drop scheme has been their preferred method really for the past 3 years. They've been more flexible this year because they learned the hard way last year what happens if you don't have a plan B here. So they do, you know, they have PJ Tucker now. They can execute more switches, but I'm curious to see how the Nets attack Lopez and really who they start. Like, who is there? Are they going to continue starting Blake Griffin at center? Are they going to put DeAndre Jordan in there to counter Giannis and make him the primary Giannis defender at first just to, again, be six fouls and build a wall for the time being? If they can figure out a way to take advantage and honestly play Brook Lopez off the floor, that's going to change some things in this matchup as well. So I think that's definitely one thing to keep an eye on.
One thing I also want to point out, and that's offensively for the Bucks. Bobby Portis and Bryn Forbes, both need to have very productive series. I mean, these are guys who can come in and really stretch the court. I don't think we as an NBA community have given Bobby Portis enough credit for the season he had with the Bucks.
Yeah.
He's been really consistent, and he's arguably been one of the best offensively inclined big men coming off the bench this season in the NBA. I mean, we're looking at 12 points per game. That might not be a wild statistical number, but he's doing it on 52% shooting. He's hitting threes. He's getting shots inside. Like, he's hitting free throws. Like, he's just really well-rounded offensively. I feel if you can get him into the game, especially in minutes where Kevin Durant is not there to guard him, like, who else do the Nets have? Like, Claxton maybe, but there isn't really a whole lot of defensive versatility up front, which means Bobby could come in off the bench and just eat from the moment he touches the floor. And he needs to do that. Like, we have to be looking at a Bobby Portis who goes for 12, 15 points per game every single night.
Yeah. And I mean, Bryn Forbes had a great series. Like, outscored Jimmy Butler, I believe, or scored around the same amount of points as Jimmy Butler in that
outscored.
First, outscored.
I'm pretty sure it was outscored.
Yeah, if Bryn Forbes outscores Kevin Durant in this series, I'm going to go ahead and pick the Bucks. Let's turn our attention now defensively. How do the Nets match up with the Bucks? Because I think that's where we have more questions. Specifically, I mean, first, who do they send to Giannis?
I think you hit it right on the head there with DeAndre. I think that needs to be DeAndre starting up on Giannis just because of the length. I know DeAndre is not the defender he used to be. Even when he was that defender back in the day, he still wasn't the defender that he was built as because of Doc.
Doc, yeah.
Defensive player of the year. Like, no. Yeah. Just no, Doc. But we're still looking at a guy who's long, who's big, who's a legit 6'11", long arms. The question to me is, can he really have quick feet over the course of an entire series? Because he looks slow-footed now compared to just 2 or 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Can he be beat by off the dribble by Giannis if Giannis just gets him just a couple feet further out of his comfort zone? Like, if Giannis can just lure DeAndre out a little bit further, I think he has to step on him, and I think that could be a matchup he absolutely abuses. But if DeAndre stays close to the basket, then I kind of want to see what Giannis's counter is. What is that, like a lane push shot, or like, I don't know what that is. Does he just go for the hammer every single time? Like, I'm going to dunk on your ass 5 times in a row. I don't know what that is. I don't know if he has that solution in him. The one thing I don't want to see from the Bucks is Giannis taking the pull-up three in transition. Like,
yeah.
Not this series. I get it. You can experiment it here and there. Not in this series. Do not take that shot whatsoever.
Yeah. I mean, this just goes for the whole team. But even if Milwaukee matches up well defensively with Brooklyn, again, you're not going to stop them. And not to go full Scott Brooks here, but, like, you do have to keep up with them offensively. You know, you do have to outscore it. So you just have to value every single possession. I agree. You can't waste, yes, Giannis has improved as a three-point shooter, but the Nets will happily live with him jacking threes throughout this series, even if he hits them on occasion. I know Zach Lowe covered this in his preview of this series, but he was saying that the potential counter, if you do go DeAndre on Giannis, is that Giannis will not necessarily operate the offense as much. He can be a screener instead of being on the ball. And that's going to get, I mean, DeAndre Jordan just does not have the foot speed to keep up with, you know, if you're running a pick and roll with Drew Holiday, Giannis is setting the screen. You're either going to switch DeAndre Jordan onto Drew, which is not going to end well, or he's got to, you know, basically be
Middleton.
In two places in one. Yeah. Middleton as well. The Bucks are going to have, I feel more confident in the Bucks' ability to match up defensively with the Nets than I do the Nets' ability to match up with the Bucks. I guess the question is, does that matter when we're coming down to, like, the ultimate who's going to win this series? Does that matter?
Yeah, of course it matters because it's over the course of an entire game. Like, it might not matter at the final seconds because great offense will always beat great defense, especially end of the game. Mm-hmm. But if you, over the course of the first 40 minutes maybe of a 48-minute game, can affect Brooklyn's offense by simply being better defensively, then hell yeah, it matters. Of course it does. The question to me is the defense that they have enough? Mm-hmm. Like, it, because, I mean, we are talking about a Kevin Durant who, despite an Achilles tear, is looking like the Kevin Durant of old. Mm-hmm. Like, James Harden is still in his prime. Kyrie Irving is still in his prime. If those three just somehow reach this collective higher level that they can all reach, good Lord, that's going to be tough. I mean, my thinking here is if the Bucks come out of this series, and I, full disclosure, I have them as my winner here, mm-hmm. then nothing that they're going to be meeting after this is going to seem as tough as this series.
Yeah, I mean, especially with the Lakers out and the Clippers on the ropes, with all due respect to the Jazz and the Sun, like, Suns already banged up. Jazz now, Mike Conley has a hamstring injury, and Embiid's got the knee injury. I have a strong feeling that whoever wins this series is going to just waltz to the championship.
This is effectively the NBA Finals.
Yeah, it feels like it. I mean, maybe we're wrong, and maybe, you know, something, God forbid, one of these teams suffers an injury later down the road. Hopefully not, but I'm just saying, you know, like,
right.
I think these are the two best teams remaining in the playoffs.
I would agree. So, Brian, just to, like, round out the Bucks, because now that DiVincenzo is out and all that, like, yeah, Pat Connaughton is going to play minutes. But looking over their roster, right? Mm-hmm. Does it feel like they're one scorer short to you?
Yeah, I mean, that's. I was going to ask you kind of which supporting cast. We know the talent for both big threes, but which one do you have more faith in, especially in the wake of the injuries to DiVincenzo and Jeff Green, who, again, you know, hopefully will come back at some point in the series? To me, I have more faith. I know what I'm going to get out of Portis and Forbes.
Yeah,
but after that, I'm nervous, and I don't know. Like, I almost feel like Bud has to run with a 7-man rotation, 8 at absolute most.
I agree.
Like, I guess, yeah, probably 8. You're going to do, you know, I'm guessing Pat Connaughton's going to start in place of DiVincenzo. So you're going to have PJ Tucker, you're going to have Bryn Forbes, you're going to have Bobby Portis. After that, I don't want to see really anyone else.
No, I agree. It does seem like you need to tighten that rotation simply because I don't trust a guy like Torrey Craig, for example.
Well, Torrey Craig's not even on the team. Jeff Teague?
Was he? Right, he's at Phoenix. Yeah. Oh, God. Oh, man. Look, I am still reeling from that trade deadline.
Yeah.
Jeff Teague, for example, who came over. I don't trust him either. Like, okay, but you know what? Let me just clarify here. If Torrey Craig was on the team, I wouldn't trust his addies either. My point is this. I don't trust guys who are defensively inclined to come in and make shots at a consistent level.
Yeah.
I don't think in this particular series you can go, oh, here we have a defensive-minded guy. Let's hope that he hits a couple shots. I think you need to have guys who are well-rounded, like PJ Tucker. So let's talk about PJ. This is a guy who I think could be a problem. Like, he's all defense right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's the corner three. Do you feel confident when he takes corner threes?
No.
I don't.
No.
Right.
I mean, the Nets will live with that shot.
Right.
Like, I don't
think... And that's what I'm saying.
I don't think
if you were playing 4-on-5, right, and if you were playing 4-on-5 at any point, like, no, that you can't.
Yeah.
You have to play 5-on-5 at all times.
Yeah. I mean, I will say this. In the Heat series, they effectively did have a 9-man rotation, and then DiVincenzo went down. And then, like, the other guys, no one after DiVincenzo played more than 13 minutes. So they, you know, they played in garbage time because the Heat got blown out in a couple games. But so I do think that Bud will realize, especially given the scope of how well their big three matches up with Brooklyn. Like, we cannot, like, Giannis is playing 40 minutes a game from the jump. We are not effing around with, you know, Giannis is playing 30 minutes and we are going to rely on Jordan Nwora and Jeff Teague. And, like, no, we're not messing around with that. So I think Bud will at least have taken the lessons that he learned from last year's playoffs. Clearly something right. sunk in given how they dismantled the Heat. But in terms of supporting cast, I agree. I think the Nets have at least more options at their disposal. If their plan A doesn't work, especially right. when Jeff Green comes back, you know, regardless of whether they start Blake Griffin or DeAndre Jordan, you can alter those two. You have Nick Claxton in there, who I think could be a big part of the series. I think Giannis is going to get him into a ton of foul trouble, but he is their most switchable defender by far. Bruce Brown is going to be really interesting to see how, because, you know, you can put him really on Drew or Middleton probably. And he's, or you're going to play him as a, I don't think you can mess around with the Bruce Brown small ball five thing. Not against Giannis.
I mean, basically you have to have Giannis or Brook Lopez in the game at all times if you're Bud, right? Because if those two guys are out at the same times, then you could, I think. What about Alize Johnson? He's got minutes.
Let's not pretend he didn't get minutes.
No, but he is a guy who could come in there and get boards, get buckets near the basket. Like, he's a high efficiency scorer near the rim. You always talk about the six fouls as well.
Yeah, that's true.
He'll pride those as well, and he'll give you rebounds, and he'll give you interior scoring. Is that a bad option?
I'm only laughing because he got a total of 4 minutes in that Celtics series. Like, he's just not part of the rotation.
Here's the thing. The Celtics also are a little bit smaller. I don't think he fits into that rotation. I think against the Bucks, who are a little bit bigger, you could justify playing Alize Johnson a little bit more.
I think both teams are going to have to tighten their rotations a lot. And, you know, the Nets went effectively 10 deep before Jeff got hurt. Tyler Johnson played 45 minutes in that Celtics series. I don't think we're going to see a ton of, unless, you know, maybe if he's going against Bryn Forbes off the bench, because that's not a terrible, like, you're not as scared of Bryn Forbes lighting him up potentially. But otherwise, you know, I think it's, you got to go Durant, Harden, Irving, all playing upwards of 40 minutes if they can stay healthy. The medical staff will be really important here. Harris is going to play a ton. Bruce Brown's going to play a ton. Griffin's going to play a ton. We'll see about DeAndre Jordan. Shamet's going to be there for shooting off the bench. Like, it just feels like the Nets have more ways to play than the Bucks do.
Offensively speaking.
Yeah. And the Bucks have the personnel to match up well, again, like, especially if you have P.J. Tucker in the non-Lopez minutes. When P.J. Tucker's out there, you can just switch everything. So I'm not saying that the Nets necessarily, even though they can go big, they can go small, whatever the case may be, the Bucks have the personnel to match up either way. I could see one of these role players for Brooklyn swing the series or swing a game, which ends up swinging the series. Whereas, you know, do I think Bryn Forbes is going to shoot? Like, what did he shoot in this Miami series? Like, just an absolutely ridiculous percentage.
Something,
48.5%. Yeah. Is he shooting 16 of 33 from three again? Probably not.
No, I agree with you. And this is where the Nets, I think, they would have been my clear-cut favorite if LaMarcus Aldridge hadn't retired and if Spencer Dinwiddie hadn't been injured.
Yeah. Oh, my God. If Spencer Dinwiddie was still... Right. I mean, you know, he's hinted at a possible return in this playoffs. I'll believe it when I see it. I don't think it's happening in this series, but... Yeah, if game four comes around and Spencer Dinwiddie's all of a sudden back in the lineup, that would certainly affect at least, maybe not my pick, but like how quickly I think this series is over.
Yeah. Wow, I'm still bothered by the fact that I completely forgot that Torrey Craig was on the Suns. This bothers me. Like, there are still moments in time where I go to a certain player who was traded back in March and I go, where the hell is he playing? Like, right now, honestly, Ernie Johnson could bring me up to who he played for, and if he took some scrub, I might actually chug it out and completely go for an over. This is how bad we are.
Well, all right. So the odds makers at FanDuel Sportsbook. This is, I think, the closest series.
It should be. If it's not, it should be.
Actually, Hawks Sixers is a little bit closer just because of the uncertainty with Embiid, I think, is. But
okay. Yeah.
But the Nets are a -184 favorite. The Bucks are a +154. But that is really super close. This is odds makers saying we don't have a great read on which team is going to win this series. So, Mort, you said you are leaning the Bucks. How many games do you think this series goes?
Like, at least six.
Yeah, I hope.
Right? And look, and then here's the thing. Like, we always talk about if a game goes seven, like, you can't sit there and go, well, I predict, like, no. Game seven is a toss-up.
Yeah.
Game seven is like a, I don't know, like something out of the Wild West. You can't. So it's either pick a winner or pick a game seven. That's how I look at it. And I'm picking the Bucks in probably six. And then if it goes seven, it can go either way. This is going to be absolutely bonkers. The one thing that would shock me, though, is if Brooklyn just came out and ran the table.
Yeah. Really?
That would shock me.
I would be surprised if... I mean, I agree with you. I think this thing's going at least six, if not seven. I would be surprised if either team won in four or five.
Can we talk about Chris Middleton for a second, though, before we wrap up on this series?
Yeah.
He's one of those guys who just completely flies under the radar, despite being a two-time All-Star. Like, he's such a great shooter. He's also an underrated rebounder. He's an underrated playmaker. He was averaging a career-high 5.4 assists this year as well. And he's a defender. He's versatile. Why is it that when we talk about series that includes the Bucks, he's almost one of those guys who's kind of an afterthought? He could legitimately be the swing guy
that
wins it for this team.
Well, he's the de facto closer because you don't trust Giannis in those like last second shots to.
I mean, you know
what Giannis is going to do. Whereas, like, if it's create a bucket on your own, we saw in the Miami series in game one, who hit the game winning shot? It wasn't Giannis, it was Chris Middleton.
Chris Middleton.
I think the problem for the Bucks is that I could see KD being on Middleton in those situations.
Yeah.
And
that was going to be my follow-up. Yep,
okay.
Go.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a ton of length. I mean, I don't think Middleton can, you know, if you're posting up Middleton against KD, like, KD still has a ton of length, and you're kind of playing right into the Bucks' hands, or the Nets' hands there a little bit. Like, I don't think that's the most efficient way to generate offense for Chris Middleton. So the matchup questions for both sides are just really fascinating, and it's going to be an awesome... I mean, I hope this goes the distance. I hope it goes seven. And it's a great chess match between Steve Nash and his staff and Mike Budenholzer and his staff. It would suck if there was like one team just found, you know, Joe Harris against Pat Connaughton, and Joe Harris just goes off for 30 points every night and the series is over in five. Like, I hope we see a lot of creative adjustments throughout the series to prolong this as much as possible.
Agree. But I agree that I think maybe that's actually the path to beating Milwaukee. If you can get Chris Middleton out of the game, if you can get him flustered, if you can get him to take bad shots, I don't think you can. He's extremely smart.
Yeah.
Like, he understands if he doesn't have it rolling, he's not going to force things. But if you can just make him a non-factor, I think that would be a huge step in the right direction if you're Brooklyn, because I love Drew Holiday, don't get me wrong, but I do wonder how much of an offensive burden he can carry. Like, if he's forced to step it up from a number three option to a number two, can he do that? I think that's a legitimate and fair question to ask.
Well, especially if he's tasked with guarding Kyrie and James Harden throughout the whole series. Like, that's going to wipe him out defensively.
Exactly, yeah.
So, I'm super torn on this series as well. You know, again, I hope it goes seven in that point. Who knows? This is similar to Suns Lakers, where, like, my head is saying Nets in seven, but my heart is saying Bucks in six. But I think I'm going Nets in seven. I don't love it either way. I could easily see the Bucks winning this series. This is no disrespect to the Bucks, but, you know, again, it just comes down to the Nets, it's hard to imagine having three high-level isolation scorers. I don't care how good defensively you match up against them. It's just like, yeah. I could just easily see, you know, KD hitting a big bucket in crunch time, Kyrie hitting a big bucket in crunch time. I guess I have less questions about their ability to generate offense, even against great defense. Mm-hmm. Whereas I still wonder about that for the Bucks. But then again, they're not going against a great defense in the Nets, so maybe it doesn't matter in this series. You can easily talk yourself into this thing going either way.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a good point. I think you shouldn't be afraid of Brooklyn's defense if you're Milwaukee as well. So if the Bucks can just get it going early and put up 35 points in the first quarter, I think that's, they have to focus in offensively, and then after they take a substantial lead, that's when they lock down. I think that has to be one of those tactics.
Yeah. All right, so let's move to the other series in the Eastern Conference. Sixers-Hawks, as I mentioned, that's even closer from oddsmakers. The FanDuel Sportsbook has the Sixers as a minus 180 favorite. The Hawks are a plus 152. We got to start with Joel Embiid, of course.
Yeah.
He's diagnosed with a slight tear in his meniscus. He is listed as day-to-day. Doc Rivers has been extremely cagey about whether he will be playing game one, but it sounds like there is optimism that this thing won't shut him down for the whole series. Let's say Embiid does not play game one. If you're the Sixers, who do you start in his place?
So against Atlanta specifically, they have Clint Capella, they have some size. Yeah, I got to go Dwight.
Yeah.
I know they like to have Dwight off the bench.
Yeah.
But I just got to go size and rebounding.
Yeah. They went with Thybul in game five against the Wizards, and Thybul went on Beal right away. So I could see them doing that here as well and putting Thybul on Trey, because I think he's honestly more than Ben Simmons even. I think he's the guy who's going to match up the best against Trey.
Right.
That said, the thought of Clint Capella as a role man and as a lob threat in particular really worries me. Like, I think the Hawks are one of the teams that actually has the personnel to match up pretty well, even with the healthy Sixers. But without Embiid, I get really nervous. I can see why this series is as split as it is if you're thinking Embiid misses a couple games or misses the whole thing. Like, if he misses the whole thing, I'm picking the Hawks.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Like, if Embiid isn't playing, I am too. I don't want to regurgitate the whole thing. I just don't trust Ben's offense at this point yet to be able to carry that over an entire series.
It's not, for me, it's not even that. It's just that they run everything through Embiid on both sides of the court. Like, they found some stuff in the second half of game five against the Wizards offensively that really worked. Tyrese Maxey in particular was fantastic. That said, like, you know, Embiid is the one, you feed the ball to him. If he's single covered, he's going to destroy you. If he's double covered, he's going to pass out to open shooters like Danny Green, Seth Curry, Tobias Harris. It's much harder to generate offense without him on the floor. And then defensively, obviously, you know, he is one of the premier rim protectors in the league. So he's going to break up Clint Capella lobs. He's going to make sure he keeps Clint Capella off the glass, because Clint Capella is one of the best rebounders in the league. He's going to, you know, thwart Trae Young from driving to the basket. You're going to force a lot of floaters from him. So, yeah, going without...
But you still need to make up for 30 points.
Yeah, right.
Like, or a point per minute if we're going off the Washington series.
Right.
I mean, I understand your point, but at the same time, you also have to consider Embiid in the regular season was at like 28.5 points per game.
Yeah.
Like, those points will have to be replaced somehow.
Yeah, and the free throw drawing too. Like, he gets opposing bigs in foul trouble. If you play Clint Capella, you know, send him to the bench early, that's going to make things a lot easier for you. The Sixers, again, to their credit, in that game five, they started passive, and then they started attacking the basket more as the game went on. And I think that's what they're going to have to do regardless of whether Embiid's in the game. But yeah, it's really, I don't know which way. I would lean Thybul again just to see, but I would have a quick hook if I'm Doc. And I would, you know, there's a real chance that the Trey Clint pick and roll they just have no way to stop it unless they have a traditional big on the court. The problem for the Sixers, especially if Embiid isn't playing, is that Dwight is their only other center. Like, this Mike Scott at the five will not work against the Hawks. You have Paul Reed, who's just still very raw, and Doc doesn't really trust him. And Dwight is extremely foul prone. So Dwight has to be, Dwight has to play smart. Like, he cannot pick up offensive fouls on moving screens, which he does constantly. He just cannot commit dumb, cheap fouls, or the Sixers will be in a lot of trouble if Embiid's not playing.
Yeah, and I don't trust him to not do that.
Nor do I. No.
Yeah, yeah. And then you can, like, okay, you're saying, like, the center rotation, you can't get away with playing Simmons at spot minutes at the five, I think, just because of his size, but it's obviously not something you'd want necessarily because he's still not that sort of rim protector like a Dwight or a Joe. Like, he's a little bit smaller in that regard, but I think you can get away with it if you want to. Like, if Dwight picks up a lot of fouls and it's between playing Ben at the five and, like, Mike Scott, then, like, is it all that bad putting Ben at the five and just saying, screw it, let's just have talent on the floor instead of Mike Scott?
Mike Scott should never play unless it's garbage time.
Right.
That's just it. We reached that point last year, and I can understand trusting him because he's a veteran, but he is, Nikias Duncan of Basketball News put it well, he is more of a spacer in theory than he is in practice. Like, he will take those shots, but he will not hit many. And it's just, and like, Ben is one of those guys where, you know, he always prides himself on making the right play. So if he's driving and they form a wall and Mike Scott is wide open, he's going to kick to Mike Scott. And Mike Scott's going to take that shot, and he's not going to hit it. So there's no point in having him on the floor. He's not providing the defense that Thybulle does. I do not want to see Mike Scott in this series unless the Sixers are up 30 in the fourth quarter.
So I've been banging this drum for a long time, and I'm going to bang it again. Seth Curry does not take enough three-pointers.
Yeah, and he was in that game five. We got a 30-point outing from Seth Curry without Embiid.
We did. That's what I need to see from him.
Yeah.
If you know, Embiid isn't playing, right, then I need to see the offense come a little bit more from the perimeter. We need to see Tobias Harris do what he can do, but we also need to see Seth just kind of accept, okay, I have to be option at least number three, if not two, offensively. I need to take 12, 13 three-pointers per game. I need to get involved in the offense. I can't just sit back and take my five spot ups or whatever it is. I need to shoot more threes than Danny Green. I mean, come on, which he's not overall. So, yeah, I'm struggling to see a scenario wherein I trust these Sixers enough in a series without Embiid against the Hawks where I would pick them as the winner. Because look, let's go to the Hawks, Brian. They're deep.
Yeah.
And like, you brought up Thybulle and all that, like Thybulle on Trae Young. That's nice. It's still Trae Young.
Yeah.
I don't trust that. I don't trust virtually anyone to guard Trae Young. Trae Young can pull up at the logo and hit. He's a guy who can maneuver screens much in a similar vein like Luka Doncic. He's a guy who's an incredible passer. If you foul him, he's going to go to the line. He's going to hit both. He's like, no, I just don't trust anyone on the Sixers to really be able to shut him down.
Right.
Like, I'm sure that on occasion Ben will get like switched over in some capacity and like guard him. And I don't trust that matchup either. Yeah. I think Trey's just too quick and too smart. Yeah. So I mean, we're looking at that team. We're looking at a Kevin Huerter who can come up and hit spot-up shots. We're looking at Bogdan Bogdanovic, who's been fabulous. We're looking at a DeAndre Hunter who can mix it up. I think they have these so many weapons at their disposal that when I look at their respective units, it's a little bit similar to Bucks-Nets in the sense that offensively, they're just so much more potent than the Sixers. And if the Sixers are lacking their best scorer and their best interior defender, just feels like it's becoming a no-brainer to pick the Hawks.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the Sixers have the second-ranked defense during the regular season, but that's because they had Joel Embiid for most of the season. If they do not have Joel Embiid, they will not have the second-ranked defense. And yeah, I mean, I think Simmons and Thybulle will be the ones who mostly guard Trae, and you know, I do think you can goad him into being a little more inefficient than you can a Kevin Durant or a Kyrie Irving. So I think that is the play. Just challenge him as much as possible. But you brought up Seth Curry, and that's a thing that I harped on in my series preview at Forbes. I don't know where the Sixers hide him defensively. In the first round, the Wizards kind of played into their hands by starting Raul Neto for three of those five games. And even when he got switched on to Davis Bertans at times, like, Bertans is not going to beat you off a dribble, or he's not going to post you up. So Curry didn't get played off the floor defensively.
Right.
Where in this starting five, like, the three regular season games, we learned nothing. The Sixers were ravaged by COVID protocols by one. Trey didn't play in the second game because he had the ankle injury. He came back in the third game, but DeAndre Hunter was still out. So, you know, Seth was stationed on Tony Snell, which, you know, Tony Snell's not going to play much, if at all, in the series. So where, if you're the Sixers, who do you put Seth Curry on defensively? And if you're the Hawks, do you just relentlessly target him until you can play him off the floor?
Yes to that last one. So Kevin Huerter isn't starting for the Hawks,
right?
But he is playing a significant chunk of games. He's playing virtually a half per game in the playoffs. When he's playing, I think that's a guy Seth Curry could guard.
Yeah.
To the point where it's like, it's fair. He's not going to slow him down, but Huerter also isn't one of those high-volume guys who will suddenly bust for 35. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, I would trust that, but in the starting lineup, Trey?
No. Like, no. Right,
but like, from a physicality perspective, that's the only one he aligns with.
I know.
So, like, let's go down the list. If he goes against Bogdan will body him to the hoop every single time. The same can be said for DeAndre Hunter. The same can be said for John Collins. Clint Capella will dunk on his ass every single time he switched on to it. Like, there isn't a good matchup for Seth Curry. There isn't.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at. So
I hear you.
I wonder, I mean, I think you're right about Huerter. So maybe with Seth, it wouldn't surprise me if they start him on DeAndre Hunter, just because that's like the best of their bad options. And I don't think the Hawks are necessarily going to run their offense through Hunter. But at the same time, if I saw that, I would be running a ton of pick and rolls with Hunter as the screener and Trey as the ball handler. And then maybe, maybe you pull Seth early, get, you know, if you don't start Thibault, bring him in when you pull Seth, and like try to match Seth's minutes as much as possible with Huerter, because I do agree that's the one best place you can hide him. But this was definitely the fear with Seth Curry as you get deeper and deeper into the playoffs. Like, teams are going to start attacking him. Washington did not have the right personnel to do so. I think Atlanta does.
And honestly, so DeAndre Hunter hasn't utilized this a whole lot in the NBA. But at Virginia, he had a post game.
Yeah.
And so I wouldn't be surprised if, like, they wouldn't even have to go pick and roll to get a, create a switch. I mean, if Curry was guarding him, clear the hell out.
Yeah.
Go to a 6'8", 225 DeAndre Hunter over a, 6'2", 185?
Yeah.
Seth Curry?
Yeah. Especially if Embiid's not in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
Who do they have as the weak side shot blocker, right?
They don't have
Dwight Howard?
Yeah.
But Howard would turn to dust if he had to run more than 10 feet over.
Yeah, and I think another thing to watch is that the Sixers struggled with defending stretch bigs this year. The Hawks have Danilo Gallinari. So, again...
Collins.
Really, John Collins, too. I think Doc's rotations are going to be really important in the series, and how he... Again, assuming Embiid, especially when Embiid is out, or if he's out for an entire game, how Doc manages these defensive challenges is going to go a long way toward determining the winner of this series. And it's almost unfair to ask you to pick a winner not knowing the status of Embiid. But
I'm going to preface it by saying that if he plays, I can hedge my bet.
Yeah. Okay, so if he, like, how many games do you think he plays in this series, I guess? And then who do you think emerges as the
winner? That's unfair. I don't know. I'm not privy to the internal details of what his medical status is. So I don't know how many games that he plays. I mean, look, it's still a partially torn meniscus.
Yeah.
That's not something you just pick up. That's pretty serious. If he play, okay, if you want me to preface this a little bit more, let's say if he plays more than three games, I think there's a reasonable shot that the Sixers could win this thing. They would have to win one without him, and that would be tough, but I do think they can if they just catch them at the right time. But, man, even then, it's pretty much a toss-up. If he plays the whole series, though, and he gets Clint Capella into foul trouble, which I think he would.
Yes.
Then I would go Sixers. In every other scenario, I'm probably going Hawks.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I went Sixers in seven for Forbes, which, again, is reflective of Embiid's status more than anything else. But
right.
I will just say this. I mean, when the bracket came out before we knew Embiid was hurt, there was this narrative that, you know, because the Sixers are the one seed, they don't get the Bucks or the Nets until the conference finals. Like, they were just going to waltz to the conference finals, cakewalk, easy, easy.
Right.
I think the Hawks proved in the first round against the Knicks that people were very severely underrating this team. This is a good team. And they, even against a full-strength Sixers squad, they would have a chance of pulling off the upset.
I would agree. By the way, is it funny to you, too, that Dwight is basically going through his former teams?
Did he ever?
Washington in the first one,
yeah.
And now is the Hawks.
If only the Lakers hadn't gotten knocked out, alas.
If only the Charlotte Hornets had made it to the playoffs.
Oh, so close. All right, let's go to Denver-Phoenix, Mort. The Nuggets knocked out the Portland Blazers in the first round, despite not having Jamal Murray. The Suns came down from a 2-1 deficit. They took advantage of a very banged-up Anthony Davis and just boat-raced the Lakers out of the playoffs in these last two games. So, again, this is injuries, I think, are looming large over this series. Chris Paul is playing through that shoulder injury. He's looked better in recent games, so I don't think we have to account for, you know, the uncertainty that we had going into Game 2. But, like, he's still... It's still a shoulder injury, and he did still, I think it was game 5 where he seemed to aggravate it and left early. So that's, you know, just something to keep in mind. Odds makers have Phoenix as a -205. The Nuggets are a +172. So Phoenix is a slight favorite to win this series. They have home court advantage as well. I think first question, you're going against the very likely MVP. If you are the Phoenix Suns, do you think DeAndre Ayton is going to be able to slow him down at all?
How many languages can I say no? I love DeAndre. I think he had a great series against the Lakers. He was flat out dominant. I mean, we're talking about 80% shooting from the field, you know, 16-11, great interior defense. That's nice. That doesn't fly against Jokic. Nothing flies against Jokic. I mean, remember when we started talking up Rudy Gobert during a podcast, and then right after we stopped recording, we realized that Jokic had like 31 points at halftime against the Jazz. I just don't care at this point who matches up against Jokic. I don't care. It could be Giannis, it could be Embiid, it could be Rudy Gobert. I just don't care. Jokic has that lockdown, that matchup on lockdown, because he's just so versatile, so great at anticipating the next play. Mm-hmm. His intelligence level is like 5 steps ahead, not just 1 or 2. Like, he's Larry Bird and Magic Johnson rolled into a 7-footer, just in terms of how he reads the court. And like, how can DeAndre Ayton stop that? What can Ayton realistically do? Sure, if he gets close to the basket, he can challenge shots. That's great, but Jokic understands that, so he'll just, I'll just settle for a 3 here, I'll take the mid-range pop here, now I gotta switch on someone else, that means I'll go into the post. Like, he's not gonna just go straight into it with DA on him. Mm-hmm. That's not gonna happen. He's too smart. No, Jokic is going to absolutely abuse that matchup. Absolutely. So no, I don't have any faith in DeAndre Ayton, and that's not a lack of it. That's not an indictment on Ayton. That's I don't have much faith in Ayton against Jokic at all.
Right, like, no one is going to fully stop. It's similar. No one's going to stop Kevin Durant. No one's going to stop Giannis. Like, you're not going to stop Nikola Jokic. I will say, from a just pure physicality perspective, 8-6, 11-250. Like, I think he is going to be able to at least hold his own in the post against Jokic, which is, you know, not an insignificant part of his game, both as a scorer and the playmaker. You know, Ayton was phenomenal in that Lakers series, especially the first four games. Like, they didn't need to lean on him as much when AD went down, but those first four games, he averaged almost 20 points, 13.5 rebounds, shot 80.9% from the field in almost 40 minutes. So, again, not that he's going to... Like, if he plays Jokic to a standstill, the Suns are waltzing through... They are marching through this series. Yeah. I don't think that's going to happen, but as long as Jokic doesn't abuse him like he did Jusuf Nurkic in that first-round series, you know, if you can even come close to holding your own against him, it's going to be a huge...
What holds him back from doing that, though? Nothing holds him back from doing that.
Yeah. Well, that is true. I mean, I guess from a playmaking perspective, his teammates. If Suns can shut down Michael Porter, Monte Morris, Aaron Gordon, Austin Rivers, who has been a very pleasant surprise for the Nuggets throughout this playoff run. So let's go into that supporting cast, because I think that's really the other question for Phoenix. Yep. What do you do against Michael Porter Jr.?
I think Torrey Craig plays for Phoenix, right?
He does. He does, in fact, play for Phoenix.
That's actually a defensive matchup I wouldn't hate, to be honest with you. Because Craig is long, he's agile, and also he's a former Nugget. He understands their schemes. He understands what they're running. I wouldn't hate seeing him on Porter Jr. That said, that doesn't mean that he's going to at any point nullify MPJ. Mm-hmm. MPJ has reached that level where he's just too good. There's now an expected baseline on what he will do. Like, if he scores under like 15 points per game in this series, everyone who knows anything about basketball will go, huh, that's out of character. Yeah. Because he's already built himself this reputation now as just a bucket getter. I'm looking at Porter Jr. to just do everything in his power to be that secondary guy, to make up for the loss of Jamal Murray and all of that. And then when I look at Phoenix, like, you got Torrey Craig, sure, but there's also Cameron Johnson, I think. I don't want to put Jay Crowder on him.
Oh, okay. Although, yeah, I was wondering.
There's a reason for that. I think Crowder is, like, he's solid defensively, don't get me wrong. I think he's a little bit too small. I think he's just not tall enough. I think Porter Jr. is so comfortable with the high release point. Mm-hmm. Again, not saying he's Kevin Durant, but there is that high... He's got the high release point and the high jumping off point. Like, I don't have a scale on how high he is up when the ball releases from his hands, but it is so high up that I don't think a guy like Jay Crowder has a realistic chance at really contesting it at a proper way. And if he does, it's going to be a foul.
Right.
So if I'm Denver, I would actually hunt out that matchup pretty well. The big X factor for me, and you probably knew I was going there, Mikal Bridges. Mm-hmm. He's got the wingspan. If memory serves, Bridges has like a 7'2" wingspan, something along those lines. It's pretty unrealistic compared to the fact that he's got a 6'7" frame. He's really got Gogo Gadget's arms. I wonder if he is physical enough to stop MPJ, but like from a length perspective, that's probably their best option. So I would say a rotation of Bridges, Torrey Craig, and Cameron Johnson just for the size and the length. And then I would try to use Jay Crowder elsewhere.
Like on Aaron Gordon, maybe?
I think from a physicality perspective, that actually aligns a little bit better. Plus, Gordon, as much as I love what he's done in Denver, his jump shooting is not one of those high release points.
Yeah.
Like, you can take away the jump shot.
Yeah.
So I would feel more comfortable if I'm the Suns putting Jay Crowder on Aaron Gordon.
That's fair. Yeah, I mean, I think from that perspective, like, the strength of Denver outside of Jokic is MPJ and Gordon. And I think the Suns have an array of wing defenders whom they can throw at those two guys. So I would give the advantage to Phoenix in that department. And then the other problem for Denver, especially with Jamal Murray out, you're looking at a backcourt matchup, a starting backcourt of Chris Paul and Devin Booker against Facundo Campacho and Austin Rivers. Now, I'm not saying those guys are, like, I don't think Austin Rivers is going to draw the Devin Booker assignment. I'm guessing that's going to be Aaron Gordon. But still, like, what do you do against Chris Paul then? Like, can Rivers or Campacho slow him down either as a scorer or as a playmaker?
Well, how's his shoulder? That's really the biggest question here, right? I mean, if his shoulder is affected, you can probably get away with a lot. If it's not, if he's like, if he's comes into this series way more healthy than before, I guess you can pray.
Yeah.
That's probably where we are. I mean, it's, I just don't see any way that the Nuggets backcourt wins this matchup at all.
No.
Like, they have nothing going for him in, if, from a defensive perspective. Like, Monte Morris was required to be basically their best backcourt player in the first round.
Yes.
Let me just look up his numbers because they were pretty insane.
Yeah, he averaged,
I kind of think we need to,
15.3 points, 5.8 assists, shot 44.4 overall, 41.7 from 3-point range.
One turnover per game because he's just that reliant. Okay, that I still love that.
By
Monte Morris, like, just his ability to protect the basketball, but. Like, okay, so it's Monte, it's Campazzo, it's Austin Rivers, it's Marcus Howard, because, look, he played. He played six games, and he played 15 minutes a game. So, you know what, Brian? Next time you doubt me on this one, shut the hell up. I told you they should run Marcus Howard 20 minutes a game. I was a mere 4 minutes and 7 off. 4.7 minutes off.
Every time he got on the floor, I was like, God damn it, I'm going to never hear the end of this.
And he hit 45% of his triple push.
I know.
Mm-hmm. No, but he's not like Marcus Howard against Chris Paul.
Yeah,
I wonder. Like, no, this is where they'll die, isn't it?
I would think so.
I mean, yeah. I just don't know what to do here, and I think also you need, if you're Aaron Gordon, you need to sort of pick up the offensive slack. You know that you're not getting a lot of the guards. You know you can't expect a repeat of what Monte Morris did in the first round. You can't expect him to come in and be 15.6 assists. You just can't. So if you're Aaron Gordon, you kind of need to go back to your Orlando roots for just a second and say, okay, I need to be on the good side of 18 points every single night.
Yeah. I mean, the Suns were one of the few teams in the top 10 of both offensive and defensive rating throughout the regular season. So it's not like, you know, what you're looking at with the Nets, where it's just going to be a track meet first to 140 wins. Like, the Suns can beat you. I mean, they proved it against the Lakers. They can beat you really either way just by, you know, they won some low-scoring slugfests, but they can also hang points on you pretty easily. So, yeah, I mean, I agree with you. The backcourt, you know, like the... Are you going to count on Austin Rivers to explode in the fourth quarter of one of these games like he did against Portland?
Probably not.
I mean, maybe he does. Like, hopefully. Yeah. I mean, if, you know, from Denver's perspective. But I just don't think what propelled them past the Blazers, I don't know if it's going to work against Phoenix, who is really one of the deepest teams left in the playoffs. You know,
like, yes, they have the bench. They definitely have the bench. And maybe it's time we start talking about Devin Booker as well. Just like we talked about the defense from the perimeter perspective of Nuggets. And look, man, I mean, Devin Booker, right? There's no one you can throw at him.
No.
Like, yeah. There's just no one. I don't even... Let me just go through that roster one more time. Like, let's go through it.
Well, that's Austin why I suggested Gordon, because it was like, he's the only one who I see, like, if Michael Porter Jr. gets switched onto him, we saw what happens.
Yeah, no, and even Gordon, Brian, because you know what? Yeah. Again, I love Gordon, but Booker is quicker.
Yeah.
Noticeably quicker. I'm looking over this roster right now. There's just nothing there.
Here's how one way to frame it. With Jamal Murray hurt, would Cameron Payne currently be the best guard on the Nuggets roster?
God, that's a good one. No, Monte Morris is there.
Okay.
No. Okay, I was. If no Monte Morris, yes. Yeah. But no, I still think Monte Morris is better than Campaign. Let's not get crazy here. Yeah. And I do think Campaso is also an underrated defender, and underrated in general. But no, I mean, like, yeah, it's a very underwhelming guard rotation they have right now. What is the status, by the way, of Will Barton? He's out, like, fully, right?
So, I mean, they... Unclear, both with him and PJ Dozier. And I think those would be the Nuggets have to hope one or both of those guys gets back in this series, because that could at least give them some more options to throw onto Devin Booker and Chris Paul.
Yes.
But yeah, currently unclear as to whether when they'll return or if they'll return.
I mean, Will Barton, if he was fully healthy, I could see that being enough to at least make this super competitive, because he'll at least give Devin Booker some fits. Like, he'll chase him around, he'll do some things, and offensively, he's a sneaky all-around guard who can slide up to the three a little bit. If he's not there, and you're basically reliant upon Jokic, Porter, and Gordon, and then there's a major drop-off.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, Paul Millsap is dirt at this point.
Yeah.
Let's put it this way, Brian. If the Nuggets come out of this series alive, it might be one of those all-time upsets.
Yes.
I mean, I would be very surprised. But look, at the same time, we're talking about the league's MVP. I mean, he's clearly the best player in the entire series by a considerable margin. I think that's fair to say. And yeah, I know some Suns fans will listen to this and go, well, Devin Booker is pretty close. No. I love Devin, but no. Sorry. Jokic is like a full tier above. He is in that first tier superstar all-around legend status at this point. It's ride or die with him, and if he can't get it done, if he just has one game where he's off, I just don't see the rest of the supporting cast have enough firepower to overcome that. He needs to be on for every single game, and he needs to basically outproduce what he already did in the first round.
Yeah.
It'll require one of those superhuman efforts, and I don't think it's fair to expect that of him.
Yeah. I think you can make a very reasonable argument. The Blazers should have won that first round series, and they are correct to have parted ways with their head coach and are now considering major offseason overhauls, because if you can't beat this Nuggets team without Jamal Murray, you're going absolutely nowhere. The Nuggets are playing with house money at this point, and the Suns will be expected to win this series, but I agree with you, especially with Barton and Dozier questionable.
Right.
I mean, the backcourt just seems so, so overwhelmingly lopsided toward Phoenix, and with the wing defenders they can throw at Gordon and MPJ, you know, again, Ayton, I think, won't stifle Jokic, but can at least give Jokic problems on the other end at times. Like, I'm going Suns and... I mean, I almost want to say Suns in five. As long as Chris...
I feel that's...
If Chris Paul's healthy, I would say Suns in five.
Hell, even if he's not. I mean, you could make that argument, even if he's not.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'm with you. I'm going to say Suns in six for one reason. I want to give you, Joker, that courtesy.
The courtesy of losing in the playoffs on his home floor.
Yeah, well, okay, fair enough. But I think he can will it out for two games. I think he will have one of those true MVP performances over two games where he just gets a W out his ass somehow, some way. And I think he can do it twice because he's that good. If this series goes seven, by the way, oh my God, I would be floored.
Yeah. They might need to make a new award, like playoff MVP, because the Nuggets aren't getting to the finals, but just give it to Jokic. Just playoff MVP.
Can I ask you a question about Jokic long term?
Yeah.
Like, if they lose out in this series, which we both think they will, you know, Jamal Murray, that's an ACL tear. That's a pretty substantial injury. It's probably taken him a year to get back, like, fully. I mean, are we looking at him, looking at that roster going, if we're going to be short every single year, I mean, do they need to do something? Is my question. No, no, no. Let's not. I'm asking whether they can do something to retain him.
Yeah.
I'm asking if we're looking at a situation where they kind of need to do something, much like in Portland, to appease Damian Lillard. Do they need to go out and do something in the summer to really show him, look, we're actually doing something here long term? So when 2023 rolls around, you have every reason to re-sign with us.
My short answer is that I will save it for the Bye Felicia that we will probably do for them in 2 weeks. But
that's fair.
But no, I don't think so. Because I think before Murray got hurt, you could make an argument, especially with the Lakers now out, they would probably be favored. If they had Jamal Murray right now and they had, you know, Barton and Dozier healthy, they'd probably be the favorites in the West right now.
Yeah, I understand that, and I agree with that. But at the same time, do we expect Jamal Murray to be back at fully
right.
what he used to be? That's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. I'm trying to look at least a year down the line.
Yeah. Well. I have a feeling we will be talking about the Nuggets' future in short order.
Fair enough.
So we would have been able to do all of the Bye Felicias for the first round. But again, the Mavericks and Clippers thwarted that plan, so we cannot preview a Jazz conference semifinal series because we have game 7 of Clippers Mavericks tomorrow. The road team has won all 6 games of this series, which just does not make sense at all.
It does not.
We had an all-time great performance from Luka Doncic in game 5. Kawhi Leonard said, "I see you, I raise you." 45 points on 18 of 25 shooting, 6 rebounds, 3 assists, 2 steals, 5 threes in 42 minutes last night to beat the Mavericks 104-97. So we're heading back to Staples Center, and if the trend holds, the Mavericks will be advancing. But
yeah,
what do you think the keys are to this Game 7?
Again, it's a Game 7. I mean, you just don't know. This is up in the air. This is really, when it comes to game sevens, it's a matter of just not missing 2 shots in a row. You catch my drift? Like,
yeah.
2 missed shots in a row in the second quarter can be the determining factor. So this is just about coming out and playing the most perfect brand of basketball that you can. And it also means that Luka has to be in his bag. He needs to be what he's been throughout the entirety of this series. Kawhi has to be what he's been. Paul George has been outstanding as well. We should talk more about him. So he should be doing what he needs to be doing. I just want to see a competitive game. And whoever remains, I'm going to be sad for the loser, because I think ultimately I would have wanted to see both these teams move on in the playoffs.
Yeah.
I think that would have been fair. But we're just looking at a situation where one of them is going to be first-round fodder, and it's unfortunate. I really don't know. I mean, I think it would be such a big upset if 22-year-old Luka Doncic, who has a very limited supporting staff, comes in and just beats Kawhi and Paul George in their prime. I mean, that would be, I don't even know where that would rank all time in terms of narrative, but it would be unparable. I can't even think of a situation that's comparable.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, on your Paul George point, this is not a pandemic P series, so you're right that we should be at least barring like an absolute pants wetting in game 7. You know, he's averaging almost 24 points on 48% shooting, 9.5 rebounds, 5 assists per game in this series, so they've gotten really great production out of him and Kawhi the whole time. Reggie Jackson was huge for them in game 6, 25 points, 9 rebounds, 4 assists. So, like, at this point, I almost feel like we know what we're getting out of the stars. You know, the stars are going to produce, and it comes down to which supporting cast comes through with more unexpected contributions. Tim Hardaway Jr. has been phenomenal in this series, so I think you can almost lump him in. Like, you know what you're getting out of Luka and Tim Hardaway. You know, does Dorian Finney-Smith knock down 5 or 6 threes instead of 2 or 3. Ultimately, I hate to go back to this, but it might come down to what version of Kristaps you get.
I think that's reasonable. That's fair.
Like, if you get the version that the Mavs wanted when they gave him a 5-year max contract, then the Mavs are probably winning this series. But if you get the version that scores 7 points on 3 of 7 shooting and can't take advantage of smaller defenders, you know, when he's trying to post up against smaller defenders and misses bunnies at the rim, as you said, every shot's going to matter in this game.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've gotten one or two good-ish Kristaps games, but the rest have been pretty underwhelming.
Yeah. I want to see Jalen Brunson get more minutes because I don't trust Porzingis' offense at all at this point.
Yeah.
I think Brunson is a more safe player to have out there in terms of offensive production, and if that means that you have to play small a little bit, then you probably have to. I understand that Rick Carlisle countered with LA going small by saying, here, guys, we're going Boban. We're going Kristaps. Right. And Boban, to his credit, has been producing.
Yeah.
11.7 plus rebounds in 17 minutes per game in this series. But I, at this point, I just want the best players out there. And right now, one of the best players out there is not Kristaps Porzingis. He's been inconsistent at the least. And I think this next game, if they lose, should be his last game as a Maverick.
Ooh, interesting. Well,
I don't think it's a hot take.
No, I don't either. But we'll save Kristaps' trade suggestions for the by Felicia. I agree with you. I mean, it just sucks. They're in a place similar to what Boston is with Kemba Walker, where you almost have to hope that they're just gonna, like, this was just a weird year and injuries affected him and he's gonna get back to the form that he previously had, because, you know, like Kemba, who reportedly does not have positive trade value at the moment, I wonder if Kristaps does.
No, I don't think he does. I don't think he does. Look, I think we talked about this a little bit last time we recorded here. He does not look the same as he did in New York.
Yeah.
He's not cutting as much. He's more spotting up. He's relying more on the three. In New York, he would even go into the post when he had someone smaller on him and try to create something. He was more forceful around the basket. He was more looking to grab alley-oops and cut in for hard dunks and layups. And, like, he was very determined going to the basket. And then he tore his ACL. And I think it's one of those Vince Carter situations where, not that Vince ever tore his ACL, but he had some foot issues. And he was going through a long stretch where he didn't trust his legs.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got traded to New Jersey back in the day, and then he kind of said, okay, fresh start, let me trust my legs again, and then he recaptured his glory. But I think Kristaps is lingering in the back of his mind, because what else is there as a reason for him not cutting to the basket a whole lot more? When we watch these games, and I've been watching everyone very, very closely, those driving lanes are there.
Yeah.
Like, even when he doesn't have the ball, there are times he could absolutely cut to the basket. He does it a couple times per game, and he does get a couple dunks out of it, but he should be doing it far more.
Yeah.
Far, far more. He should be just looking at that rim going, I'm going to absolutely murder you right now. And he just doesn't. Posting up smaller players and turning around for a jump shot within 8 feet of the basket? Are you kidding me?
Well, I mean, the Clippers right now, because they're not starting Zubac, they're starting a 6'2 Reggie Jackson, a 6'8 Nick Batum, 6'8 Marcus Morris, 6'8 Paul George, 6'7 Kawhi Leonard. Kristaps, I believe, is listed at 7'3", so he has 7 inches, a 7-inch height advantage over anyone in the Clippers starting lineup. I mean, I agree with you. Like, the post-up turnaround jumper, get rid of that immediately. But, like, he should be watching Joel Embiid tape. And just face these guys up. None of them are big enough to stop you. Like, just take open mid-range jumpers.
Well, he doesn't have the footwork of Embiid, though.
No, I know.
Chris Bosh instead.
Okay,
Watch Chris Bosh tape instead.
Yeah.
I think that, like, the similar sort of, like, lanky frame, first step sort of thing. I don't know. But honestly, I wonder if Kristaps is just a regular season player.
Hmm. I mean, if he can't take advantage of much, much smaller defenders against him,
right?
Then yes, probably so.
And also, like, defensively.
Yeah.
5 blocks in 190 minutes?
Yeah.
Really? You're 7'3". You have a lot of these guys in Kawhi, Paul George, and Reggie Jackson that actually goes to the basket. Like, the Clippers change strategies. They are going to the basket a lot more now.
Yes. Yes.
And you can't convert over, rotate over, and use your long-ass frame and long-ass arms to block shots? Or really? Like, he's just... I understand he's improved his defensive positioning. That's great. It's just not enough. You need to do more on both ends. So let's turn the page and talk about something positive. You brought him up. Tim Hardaway Jr.
Yes.
So, he's just been this outstanding three-point shooter this series. I think that's made the entire difference for him. That's just been him being able to hit threes at the rate that he does.
Yes.
One of the things is that there is a Luka component to that. Yes. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he's also been producing when Luka hasn't been directly involved.
Yeah.
Like when he's gotten a pass of Jalen Brunson or Maxi Kleber, whatever. I wonder if he's the priority going into the offseason as well at some point. Like, I know we'll get back to that.
Yeah.
I'm starting to think that might be a good idea for the Mavericks to prioritize his return.
Yes. Oh my gosh. And I mean, for him too. Like, I don't think it's one of those situations where it's like probably best for both parties to stay together, because if he leaves and goes somewhere else, unless he goes to the Lakers and plays with LeBron James, right, you know, plays with a similar, if the Nets could somehow squeeze him in, he could play with James Harden, whatever. If he plays with a similar type playmaker, then maybe he can keep up this level of production. But we've seen Tim Hardaway in past years in other situations, and that isn't to say he might not have improved over these couple of years in Dallas, but I think it's a symbiotic relationship between him and Luka. And yes, I mean, him shooting almost 46 from three and knocking down, I mean, what, I think like in all three of their wins, he's knocked down big three-pointers late in the fourth quarter to kind of stem a potential Clippers run. So, if he can maintain that level of efficiency in Game 7, I tweeted last night, man, like he has made all of the money that Dennis Schroeder and Andre Drummond lost in the playoffs. Like, he has made himself a ton of money, regardless of how this series ends. He's going to be one of the, you know, because this free agent class has been so picked over already, he's going to be one of the better free agents on the market now.
I agree. And here's the thing to me that's most important. He produces in the playoffs.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, that's what you need to pair your stars with. That is guys who can produce in the playoffs. Clearly, Tim Hardaway Jr. feels confident and enough to say, I can take these shots, because some of the shots that he's taking from three are pretty far out, and even so, even though they're far out, they're still contested. Mm-hmm. Like, he's taking threes with guys who are a foot or two inside of like his shooting area, and he's knocking those bad boys down. I think he's a guy who's just ready for that platform. He's ready for that moment. He's ready to say, you know what, I trust my capabilities, I trust my shooting, I trust my skills at these very crucial stages of the season. Whereas Porzingis, and to be fair, Dorian Finney-Smith, maybe don't to the same extent.
Yeah, and he's able to create off the dribble for himself too.
Yeah that is so important.
Yeah, it's not to the extent that Luka is, and he's not going to play make or create for others like Luka can, but having just another guy who can attack the basket off the dribble by himself, draw a foul, or just hit a layup, it eases the burden on Luka for sure.
Yeah, and it also has a ripple effect. So let's say Luka gets into the teeth of defense, they collapse, and he hits Tim Hardaway Jr. with a pass, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, sometimes guys catch a pass and they're either wide open or they're just not open enough so a defender can come out and really contest.
Yeah.
He's good enough to put the ball on the floor, recognize that pattern. Like, oh, okay, here's a closeout coming. I can do the one fake and then I can put the ball on the floor and get to the basket, or I can get to the mid-range area and pull up. Mm-hmm. I think you need to have that type of players next to a Luka, or next to a LeBron, or next to one of those, to the elite playmakers. You can't just have spot-up shooters.
Yeah.
You need to have guys who can at least put the ball on the floor 2 to 3 times and do something when there are closeouts, because otherwise you're just passing the ball around like hot potato. You need to have guys who can put the ball on the floor.
Yeah. So I know you are wary to predict a game seven, but who do you think?
Yeah.
Who do you think advances?
The Clippers.
Yeah. I don't want to.
And look,
I don't want to bet against Luka, but I mean, I agree.
Yeah. And also, I want to say this. The Clippers, I think, present the best opportunity to beat the Jazz of the two.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
Yeah. If the Mavericks win this one and they go up against Utah, then I think we need to have a conversation. We can save that for a different podcast. But let me just put it this way, and then we can move on to the next subject. Luka Doncic in this series, I don't think there is another series out there or another team in the NBA that can throw as many versatile defenders at him as the Los Angeles Clippers. And he's been absolutely just owning that, dominating that against Utah, where his primary matchups are going to be 6'1" Mike Conley, 6'2" Donovan Mitchell, a very slow-footed Joe Ingles, a not very defensively competent Jordan Clarkson. Man,
they would throw Royce O'Neal on him. That would be
okay. Well, then if they do that, then screen and roll.
Yeah, I know.
Boom,
yeah.
Get him out of the picture.
Yeah.
So I mean, good lord, he would eat.
Oh, he would.
I'm not saying they would win, but he would eat.
He would hunt Bojan Bogdanovic would not be playable.
Right.
He would just wipe him off the floor.
There's a scenario here where he would average for 40.
Yeah.
I mean.
I almost hope they advance just to see Luka go wild, but I agree with you. I think the Clippers. I mean, one home team has to win one game in this series, right?
I mean, maybe. Yeah, I don't know.
We're one game away from it not being true, but like, has that ever happened?
Hilarious.
Has it ever in NBA history been all seven games won by the road team?
Nope. I think they talked about it. I'm pretty sure that game six was the record.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm fascinated to see how this plays out. Well, we will be back later this week to talk more playoffs. We have a lot of Bye Felicias to get through as well now that a lot of the first round teams have been sent packing. So plenty to sink our teeth into, especially with the Lakers and Blazers who have already gotten rid of their coach. Plenty more to come. So thanks as always for listening in today. Please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We're being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. And thanks for listening to our live show on Locker Room. If you liked our show, please be sure to start your own room and engage with other fans on the app. Download the Locker Room app in the Apple App Store to be a part of our podcast. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort. Enjoy reasonably timed basketball games tomorrow.
Thank you. I'll print out a photo of Torrey Craig in a Suns uniform so I actually remember where he's playing now. God.
Good. All right. I'll catch you later, man.
Later.